We welcome our pastor in residence, Pastor John Zeile.
Thank you. It's I don't know which one I'm on. I'm wearing two different microphones. None of you can hear. I'm sure you won't tell me. We'll let the sound crew sort that out. 14 St. Louis Vicars, it is good to be back on the campus here. Andrew Whaling was the immediate predecessor to the one I'm now serving as bishop. That's Ken Green down in Stuart, Florida. Andrew's here someplace. At least he said he was going to be here. Wandering in, I have a story or two to tell about him as I get into the topic today. The topic that I wanted to talk about today is not particularly scholarly. President Johnson would tell you that. He remembers me from the last class I took from him in Christian apologetics about a year and a half ago. He had the flu, half the class had the flu, and I think we kind of missed together about 60% of the class time, about 40% of the class time. And it was in Christian apologetics. I wrote a term paper which reminded me how long it had been since I had written a 20 or 25 page paper. I learned that word processors can be a curse rather than a blessing, because in my day, 21 years ago, I'd stay up all night and hand the stack of index cards to the typist with the interludes between paragraphs all stacked up, and she'd close her windows so the wind wouldn't blow them all over the place and then type from a stack of cards. The advantage to that is, of course, what you have written, you have written. Word processing, as many of you know, the thing is never done, because you bounce into it again and, oh, I'll change that, I'll fix it, I'll revise it, and it's living sometimes after you've even put it to bed. When I say it's not scholarly what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to talk about death, and I think that death can be a scholarly subject, but it's not very scholarly when it's in the life of the parish, because one of the things you discover over a period of time is that the wonderful formulas and foundations that I received on this campus in 67 to 71 were foundational and terribly important in my learning how to do the practice of pastoral ministry. I came out of here as equipped, as well equipped, I think, as anyone in the present day will be, to go out and serve people, not only preaching the law and gospel, but being a salesorger, that is, a carer of souls. What I want to share with you is sort of an etymology, that kind of an emerging sort of awareness that I had about the principles of pastoral care to people who are dying. I think it's a good time to do it. It's All Saints Week, because saints are known to die before they live forever with our Lord. And to do that, I'm going to do some reflective stuff on four different circumstances I encountered, each of them different. So different that hopefully you'll see that the assumptions with which I began in practicing the care, pastoral care to those who die, you'll see that those assumptions that I had early on began to crumble along the way. Where I hope to conclude is with some observations about whether there are, in fact, any common principles, common foundations that are useful in treating and dealing with folks, the saints who die. I never met the first person that I buried. In fact, I never saw the first person that I buried. But then I was only a vicar when it happened. But don't worry about that, because it was done under the aegis of my bishop. He was on vacation. The district president knew about it. I was just filling in. The practice in that area of the country was, at least in the funeral home, to leave the casket open during the funeral. All I saw of the deceased was the top of his head. I did a pretty good job, I thought. I'd been on vicarage at least 3 days when this presented itself. I guess that's one type of bishop management. You bring the vicar on site and then you head off for 2.5 weeks on vacation. So I did, I thought, an ordinary, or a little better than ordinary job. After all, it was my first time, and each of us, the first time, likes to think that it went okay. I learned the lie of that when I was riding back from the cemetery in the limousine with the pallbearers. What I discovered in their conversation after the fact was that what I had said in terms of scriptural selection and what little I even knew about the person who had died, was a flaming contradiction to what, in fact, the type of person he was. I was embarrassed by that because I wanted to do appropriate pastoral care to the family and a respectful and gospel-centered proclamation to the person who had died. And I think I had fulfilled somewhat the former of that, but I had failed miserably in the latter part, being on target, fitting the gospel in some sort of congruent fashion to the life that had now come to an end. Not too many years ago, a parent called me, and they were really upset because I was teaching the prayer, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I ask the Lord my soul to take, and this I ask for Jesus' sake. Amen." And I said to the parent, "What's your problem?" She said, "You're teaching children to be afraid of the night. You need to change that prayer because death is a scary thing. And figure out some other way to make death more palatable to young people." I had grown up with that prayer. I expect some of you did too. And I had really never given it much of a second thought. But what had been traditional to me had become really offensive to other people. Death is not without its humor, of course. The story about the pastor who decided after a year or so in his congregation that it was time for people to take death a little bit more seriously. So Holy Week being as good a time as any to talk about death, he mounts the pulpit and his opening line after his text was, "Every member of this congregation is going to die." There was a pause. People kind of sat back and sat up, except one fellow in the third row started to smile. And that threw the preacher off, and he restated his opening line and then really moved into the whole passion thing with a capital P about suffering and death and how all of the stuff of Ecclesiastes. He pulled out all sorts of other things and then concluded, "As we enter Holy Week, you must remember that every member of this congregation will die." And by this time, the guy was grinning broadly. After the service, he was shaking hands outside, and he talked to this fellow who came up and greeted him with the same broad grin and said, "I can't understand it. I just finished talking about death and mortality and Lent. I mean, what could be more Lutheran?" And the guy, "How can you smile?" And the guy said, "It's very simple. I'm not a member of your congregation." Four opportunities at ministry. I didn't grow up on television. I grew up with television. The late 40s, I think, or mid-40s, was when TV first started to be. And in the early days of television, before color TVs or widescreen things up in Lober 2, where you can watch Monday Night Football if the fireside chat doesn't go too long that night, was a show called This Is the Life. Still around, I guess, or another redaction of it is. Back then, it was Pastor Martin. Nelson Lay, some of you in the room remember that. What I remember about that caricature of the Christian family and of the Lutheran congregation was that Pastor Martin always knew what to say. He always wore a suit and a tie. He was always clean-shaven, no matter what time of day or night. He always, no matter how awful it seemed to be, had the right words to say. He would come in and his presence itself was just a very calming sort of thing. Sort of a demeanor like Dick Warnock here, composed, and he had the hair and the demeanor and everything to come in, the presence that just came right out of the tube and made everything just okay. I thought of him a lot when I started dealing with Lola some years ago. Lola and Lillian were twins. They said of each other that Lola was the thinker and Lillian was the talker. They lived in the same town and had lived there for a long time. In fact, they were natives, unusual in an area where most everybody was from someplace else. Their kids had stayed there too. Their grandkids had stayed there as well. And it was one of those families that had two or three generations in the same town, wonderfully supportive sort of people. oh, normal feebleness set in as Lola began to age. But then they called me one day and said, we just found out that Mom has cancer. We don't know what that means, except that it is cancer. We don't know how long she will live, but we wanted you to know as her pastor. There's no need for you to come and care for her now because we know that everything's going to be okay. They were in church every Sunday, in Bible class all the time, leadership positions in the church. And so time passed, and we took care of Lola, talked with her as her condition seemed to be on hold. But then it became time for the hospice to do their arts with her. The pain of the cancer became such that it needed management with Brompton's mixture, some of those mixtures hospice can use of a very low volume so that a person with cancer is able to ingest them and not become nauseated from them. Pain management. Lola went through that particular phase where in the early phases of hospice care, sometimes the patient feels so much better, they think they're going to get better, when in fact, as you know, in hospice care, to get in there, you have to have a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live. Her condition worsened even more, and she maintained this radiant serenity, never really talked too much, but her family was with her in the hospice room. Then one night they called, and they said, we think, the nurse has said, that Mom's time is coming. And so they called me to come over, and I will never forget the picture of what I saw in that daycare room, or the day room at the hospice. Lovely room, sort of like this one. Lots of windows, lots of furniture, soft, comfortable chairs. And I got there, and Lola was in one of these big, kind of a super lazy boy sort of chair, kind of in and out, drifting in and out. And you had to see it to believe it, because next to her was her daughter holding her hand. Behind her was her son-in-law. To the right were her grandchildren. On a table next to the chair was a Lutheran hymnal, a small catechism, and a copy of the King James Bible. In retrospect, I thought I had walked onto a stage set. That is the only time in my life, to say nothing of my ministry, that I saw something like that there, and it was real. They were using that as they sang hymns, as they read parts of the catechism, and as they shared Holy Scripture with their mom. To say that I felt a little bit useless at that point, or at least superfluous, is kind of an understatement. But I saw that and I thought, oh my heavens, this family, it is something, it could have been on This Is the Life. This is how death ought to be. At least 70, she had outlasted that by another 10 years. I think she was in her high 80s by then. And I talked with them and prayed with them, and then they said, Pastor, why don't you go home? You look tired. Everything will be fine. She died about 5 o'clock the next morning. They called me at 9, and they said, the first thing, we hope you rested well last night because Mom is at rest with her Lord Jesus Christ. I wandered into that funeral. It had been already planned as far as the content of music and scriptures, as someone feeling like he was a member of the family. It was wonderful. I went in and preached, and a number of the other family members had died over the years. And it was sort of like, in fact, I said to them in that homily, if you have to be careful because you might have to adopt me into your family. And they could say afterwards with a smile, you know, with the experience you've had with our family, if we adopt you, there may not be a very long future in that adoption because you're burying so many of us. But it was that kind of warmth. And I thought, holy smokes, everything, all of the tools that I knew, the catechism, the Bible and the hymnal, and all of that stuff was there. How wonderful. An interesting footnote was that her sister Lillian, her twin sister, dropped dead about two years later. She dropped dead after she had gotten dressed for morning worship at my congregation. She was in her bedroom picking up her purse, and her daughter found her on the bed, you know, in eternity on a Sunday morning. And in that life, too, I could say at the funeral, well, I guess Lillian today decided to worship elsewhere. It made sense because it all fit, and it is a truly wonderful experience. And I thought that that's the way that death ought to be. The phone rang, second instance. The phone rang. Angry parishioner said, "Pastor, we have to do something about this." You'll get calls like that. And I said, "Well, who is this?" They hadn't told me. Well, they told me. I said, "Okay, Ralph, what is it that you're talking about?" "Well," he said, "you didn't know this before you came to this parish, but every October, the same people set up this haunted house in the back end of the fellowship hall. And it's simply got to stop. They scare the devil out of these kids. They do all kinds of crazy stuff, and I think that's inappropriate to be done on church property." And I said, "Well, Ralph, I tell you what, I'll help you out with that one if you in your earnestness will help me out with the biggest pagan festival that our culture has ever seen." "Oh," he said, "Pastor, I'm completely with you. I'm going to do it. What is it?" And I said, "Christmas." And he stopped and he said, "Ouch." "Christmas?" I said, "Sure. You know, Santa and all that sort of stuff, giving, getting rather than giving and all that. If you help me out in a creative way to translate to people in this parish the essence of the Christmas story in a culture that's so intent on grabbing rather than giving, I'll see what I can do about Halloween." The first time I met Carol, she and her husband were the people who put up the haunted house in the fellowship hall of the church. She was the witch. He was dressed like an undertaker. It was a drill all of the time, set up, you know, with the tapioca brains and all that sort of stuff that they do in there. I never went in there. I didn't like that sort of thing. Annually, it was a ritual for them that they would set this up so that the little kids could go in and have, their words, fun. A couple of years after I got to know them, Carol began to get sick. She had strange assortments of maladies. She didn't take care of herself. Her hair started to fall out. She lost her appetite and lost lots of weight. People were worried about her. She started staying away from church. We talked to her and said, "You know, is there anything wrong?" And she said, "Not really. I just don't feel very well." We talked with her some more, and 20 to 30 or 40 different people sought to bring her back into involvement. "Come on over to the church and stuff bulletins. Come on over to the church to a fellowship dinner." And she wouldn't come because her self-care, you know, she wouldn't bathe. She wouldn't comb her hair. Her teeth were starting to rot because she was not brushing her teeth. She grew further and further depressed, and she would call me and say, "Pastor, I just feel like I've lost my faith, like something has hold of me, and I don't have any control over that sort of thing. Is there anything that can help me? Do you know anything about these things?" And I reassured her with the toolbox that had come with me from seminary, that had served me so well with Lola and with Lillian. And I talked with her about the comfort and the strength of the Spirit and faith as a gift and all of the things that we know so well and we learn them so well and write about them so well and preach about them so well. And this conversation went on from time to time. She would talk and she would say, "I understand that, but I just don't feel right." And then it was about a month or so later that she took her first handful of pills. And we took her to the hospital and put her in for 30 days. And she started reading about schizophrenia in the hospital and started questioning her psychiatrist about schizophrenia. She said, "I feel like someone has a hold of my mind, like I'm not even belonging to myself." And she asked me about demon possession. "Is there such a thing, Pastor? What do you know about demon possession? What can you do about demon possession? Am I just caught? If I die, if I have lost my faith, will I go to hell? Will God still care for me?" And all of a sudden, my picture of Lola surrounded by her family was being a little bit distorted because what I had tried to do there somehow didn't make any sense here. And I sought to comfort Carol and talk with her and assure her through her hospitalization as she began to relax, as a psychiatrist who happened to be a Christian, incidentally, was working with her. And she looked better as she concluded her treatment. She began to take care of herself. And I thought, perhaps perhaps there will be some sort of a resurgence of energy and restoration. She would come to church occasionally, and she did, and people would take her to lunch and lift her up and all that sort of thing. And things were getting better. And then at 5 o'clock one Saturday afternoon, the phone rang in our vicar's house. I wasn't home. I was out someplace, gone again, my wife would say. The phone rang at the vicar's house. He was gone, too. I guess he learned some things from his bishop. And Miriam, Andrew Whaling's wife, answered the phone, and an unidentified caller said, "Is the vicar there?" And she said, "No, but he'll be back in a half an hour." And the caller hung up the phone. At 7:30 that night, I got a call from the lieutenant of the police department. Carol's husband had come home and had found her upstairs. She had stepped on the trigger of a shotgun and had ended her life. Andrew and I went over there. I called him and I said, "I think you need to come with me, not only to see this, but also to share it," because he had been as deeply engaged in this whole process as I had. We went over. The coroner was there. We could see the flash bulbs going off in the bedroom as they went around about their tasks. The son had come. The husband had come. We sought to try to begin to make some sense out of that whole scene. In one sense, it was a surprise. In another sense, it was not a surprise. They had been living with that whole situation for well over 2 years. As we talked about the crushing reality of what had happened, we shared prayer, we shared the gospel, but mostly tried to sort out things about how do you say anything in the midst of an awful tragedy like that. We planned the funeral service, and the text that was picked for that day, because one of the questions, incidentally, the family had is, does the church bury suicides? My grandfather, a pastor up in Michigan, in the days when you didn't bury suicides, or if you did, you kind of put them in a separate sector of the cemetery, got real with that when a pastor in Michigan committed suicide. And front and center in Grandpa Andrew's pastoral practice was the decision, do you do it or don't you? And he did. That question came about Carol. We planned the service. And one of the texts used was Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, what shall separate us from the love of Christ? Those words took a strange kind of relevance, powerful relevance. We say it sometimes, roll through it, with the cultural equivalent, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, or the tough go shopping, or something like that. Carol was the brilliant example, or tragic example, of sometimes when the going gets tough, that people break. What shall separate us from the love of Christ? And you know the laundry list of things. And Paul wraps it up by saying, nothing in all of creation can separate us from his love, which is in Jesus Christ our Lord. And the last word of the homily to the family was, not even what she has done. Because she had told me in the middle of her struggle that she knew God cared for her. She knew that her sins were forgiven. But she was simply no longer able to cope with what life had become for her. The irony of it all is that her funeral was on October 31st. Not Reformation. Halloween. Reformation 2. Then there's another one. Phone call came on December 20th. "Pastor, this is Scott. Will you come on over and decorate our Christmas tree with me?" Now, those of us who have been in the ministry for a while know what December 20th is like. Even if you've got the liturgies finished, if you've got four or five services staring you in the face, plus a family tugging at you for all of the emotional and personal availability that sometimes they're bereft of, because that's peak time for us to be at church, knows that a request like that is probably going to go to the end of the list, maybe the maybe or want-to-do list, but not a high priority. I was over there in a very short time, and this is why. Some of you who have called the Southeastern District office over the past years may have known the cheery receptionist that answered the phone. Her name is Jay. She served in her previous job as operations director for ABC News in the Washington Bureau, and as a member of the congregation, invited me over to meet with her because she was chair of our stewardship board. I went over there and walked in on DeSalle Street in Washington, D.C., walked in the front door, and this absolutely gorgeous blonde got up from the reception desk on the ground floor and said, "Pastor Ziley, it's so good to see you." I had never seen her before. I had no idea who she was, but she greeted me like an old friend, which is enough in some circles to give you pause. She said, "They're waiting for you upstairs. Please step into the elevator and go up there." I did, to whatever floor it was. A brunette met me as the elevator doors opened. "Pastor Ziley, we're so glad you're here. Jay's waiting for you. It's just wonderful that you were able to take time out of your busy schedule. Come on down the hall." Went into her office, and I said to Jay, "This is really amazing, you know, that people are just so friendly here." And she looked at me with a big smile, and she said, "It's all show business, all show business." She would refer to Ted Koppel and Sam Donaldson as the talent. That's what she did. Her job dried up. They reorganized. She stayed on for a while because her task, having worked at ABC 10 years, was to know where all the hatchets were buried. And whenever some new commander-in-chief would show up with all kinds of bright ideas about what to do, Jay's job was to let him know that it's probably not a good idea to have two long-time antagonists on the same television set together. She went to work for the church because she had always wanted to do that. Single parent, outgoing, busy as can be, Scott the apple of her eye, Jay had lost both of her parents, was living with her grandmother, who herself was, I think, 97 at the time, 97 or 98, and managing things very well. And then suddenly a phone call came one day. It came from the district office, and they said, "Something's wrong at Jay's house. We don't know. Grandma called, and she's not making any sense. She's terribly upset." And so I called, first of all, the district to see if they knew anything. Then I called over to the house. They didn't know anything except the confusion over there. And I got over to the house. It was not far from the church. Wandered over there just a few moments after the helicopter had left. What had happened is that Jay had taken Scott to one of his gifted and talented classes over at the high school at 7:30, had come back to her house to get ready to go into work, had stopped her car at the top of the driveway, which sloped down a hill into her backyard, got out in front of the car to pick up the newspaper, and the car rolled over her, dragged her down the hill into her backyard, and she was pinned underneath the car for what we estimate about 2.5 hours until Grandma had gotten up from bed, 96-year-old Grandma, to fix her breakfast and saw the car in the backyard. Grandma herself, with heart conditions and all sorts of other maladies to which she always said 96 or 97-year-olds are entitled, walked out into the backyard and called out, "Jay, Jay," and her hand, covered with blood, came out from under the car and said, "Grandma, you better call the paramedics." They lived right across a cul-de-sac from a rescue squad. They could have run there more quickly than they could have driven, literally. They were there literally in seconds. And as they pulled her out from under the car, all of the stuff inside that had been broken, massive blunt force trauma, they called it, cut loose. She lost consciousness like that. They put the trousers on her, those inflatable deals, blew them up, got her going again, put her in the helicopter, shot her off to Fairfax Hospital. And there we were, left to deal with an awful, awful tragedy, wondering what in fact was going to happen with that sort of thing. And it was eons removed from the hospice room and the catechism and the hymnal and the Bible. We called the hospital and they said, "I'll have you talk to a social worker." I asked the social worker, "What's going on?" He said, "You better come to the hospital." And I said, "I need to know, is she conscious? Can I talk to her? Can I see her?" He said, "You've been doing this for a while. You know what I can and cannot say over the phone, and you know what it means when a social worker tells you, you better come to the hospital. That is code, if you know, for the patient is either about to or has in fact died." Andrew and I sailed up there and saw her 10 minutes after she had died. Her ex-husband arrived. His new wife arrived. He in his BMW, she in her Acura, yuppie to the hilt. All of a sudden, their life too was about to change with Scott and Grandma. What sense do you make out of that absolute tragedy in the pre-octave of Christmas? What do you say to people when all of a sudden they haven't even put up their Christmas tree and mom is pinned under a car and everything for them changes? It is a long way from the comfort of Lola's last breaths. At the funeral service, the opening phrase was from a Christmas carol. "I wonder as I wander out under the sky, how Jesus our Savior was born for to die, for poor lonely people like you and like, excuse the grammar, I." And what we discovered in that moment was that the tinsel of Christmas and the wrapping had been removed for us. And it was a time for us to discover the incarnation in all of its power. That the glitz and the glamour, the caricature of Santa Claus, you know, that offensive cartoon of Santa Claus up on a ladder propped up against the arm of the cross, Santa Claus whispering into Jesus' ear, "So long, it's been nice doing business with you." All of that was just kind of ripped away, and we were faced with the reality of one who was born not for us to coddle him, but born for to die for poor lonely people like you and like me. We commended Jay in the midst of unknowable reasons to the care of a God who has declared himself for us in his Son, his newborn Son, Jesus Christ. Another one, and this is the toughest one. It's one thing to deal with people who are not trained in the clergy. It's another thing to deal with people who are fellow clergy. It's sort of like you give it your best shot in the pulpit, you give it your best intentions in other teaching and all that, and if people who are not theologically trained respond, we feel good about that because we've done our job. But when you try to deal with someone who is trained as you are, who goes to the same seminary that you have attended, who has had some of the same professors and heard some of the same war stories from the same professors that you've had, it's sort of like trying to play baseball when someone in center field can read the signals between the catcher's legs before the pitch even comes down the pike. It's an uncomfortable sort of thing. And so it was that Glenn, one of my colleagues, called months ago and said, "You know, we're so excited because we're expecting a baby." Well, now that happens, doesn't it? Andrew and Miriam Whaling are expecting baby. I saw them last night, and they're looking forward to a birth in early next year. Our current vicar, Ken and Peggy Green, are expecting a child. If any of you know them, the babe is going to be born June 7th. That happens, except that Glenn and Kathy had gone through fertility stuff. They had been waiting for years for this day. And their joy was palpable over the phone. I could even feel Glenn's smile from thousands of miles away. It was just that neat a thing. We tracked with them through the pregnancy, and as the time came, Barb and I said, "You know, one of these days they're going to have a baby." And the next day the phone rang, and I answered. It was Glenn. He said, "Guess what?" And I said, "I think I know." And he said, "We have mixed joy." And I said, "Oh?" "Yes," he said, "Carissa was born yesterday, but we know now that she has a genetic anomaly. I think it's trisomy 16 or 17. and she is in extremely serious condition. Pray for us. And so we did. And I talked to Barb about what that means. My wife is a pediatrics intensive care nurse and knows far more about disease than I care to know, frankly. She said there are two cases that she knew of that had lived past 1 year with that particular anomaly. And she knew of two that one had died at age 12 and the other at age 14, both needing institutionalization, both, you know, not living in any stretch of the sense a normal life. And so having heard that, our prayers took a different tack. For what do you pray when people speak of a birth like that as mixed joy? The fulfillment of a promise, a child, but mixed with the terror, really, what we were feeling of what that might mean. We waited and we prayed and we kept calling, and 2 or 3 days later we kept calling out there and there was no answer, and our hearts sank because we didn't know what was going on. Not knowing sometimes is worse than knowing. And finally, a mother-in-law picked up the phone and she said, Glenn and Kathy have gone to the hospital and we don't know what's going on. So we talked with her a little bit and then we hung up. And later that evening, the phone rang, and it was Glenn again. And he said, John, I'd like you to come out and preach the funeral for Carissa. And I said, without even looking at my calendar, you don't refuse something like that. And we talked for a while and wept together a while. Then I hung up the phone and I said to Barb, I gotta go, but what will I say? Swift to its close ebbs out life's little day, but so soon? Get real, God, why now? Why fulfill a promise and then why take it away? I thought of Professor Nagel's concluding thing about the typhoon and baptism yesterday, and that is such a helpful image. Because it is so real, a God who makes alive, but a God who kills. But what sort of sense do you make of that sort of thing to someone who probably is as good at pastoral care as you are? What in the world do you do? Went out there and talked with them and thought all the way out what in the world I could ever say, and decided that what I would do is go to another daughter's death. And that was the daughter of Jairus. Worked on that text, that private little audience, you know, Peter, John, and James, standing in amid the laughter of the crowd who knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that she was stone cold and really dead and all that. And I looked at that and I said, that's got to either be the most relevant or the most irrelevant text to this situation that there is. It was like the forthcoming Old Testament lesson, Jacob wrestling with the angel, determining, trying not to let go of it until there was some sort of blessing in there someplace. Got out there, met them, talked with them, and the day for the funeral arrived. And then, as we wandered into church, the custom there, as in some places here, is to have the casket out in the narthex, lying in state, so that people may see that before the service begins. Carissa was in the narthex, about so large, about so wide. A little doll she was, looking far more beaten than her 3 days. It had not been an easy time. Before the processional hymn, I looked at her and I was thinking about the sermon text and the classic words of Jesus saying, little girl, Talitha Kumi, I say to you, arise. And I said those to her and she didn't get up. She didn't rise. As I had worked with that text, I thought, where can the comfort be? And you know, the comfort came in one of the last places I would have thought it would come, in exegesis. And I mean that positively, because I discovered a link somewhere, and it's been a while since I've worked this one, a link between the phrase of Jesus to that little girl, I say to you, arise, to the talk of resurrection. When another father's whose heart would break would say to his son, it's time to arise. And even though Jairus' daughter is going to die again, even though we all are saints who will die, we are all privy to the words on the last day when he says to us as he says to his son, I say to you, arise. What we've been through are four different situations that have one thing in common, and that is saints who die. What we've also been through is kind of a hodgepodge of witness of the Holy Scripture and pastoral care, and the struggle, the crucible really, which effective pastoral care is, when we learn in very real situations that in the midst of life we are in death. What I have learned is that what I thought should be the prototype for how death should be, the Lola episode, the Lola life, death, and funeral, was itself an anomaly, an unusual occurrence. But then I have also come to discover that every death, and there have been several hundred but with whom I've now dealt by this time in ministry, every one of them, theologically speaking, is an anomaly. Because, as Jesus would say elsewhere in the Scriptures, from the beginning, that was never God's intention. From the beginning, it was not so. And discovering that has freed me, as I hope it frees all pastors, to walk into the valley of the shadow with saints who die, who know that the God who follows you there, who walks with you in the shadow, is himself the one who says to his son, arise, who also says to us on that last day to come forth. A couple of concluding observations. When death occurs, it is a time, of course, for Christian witness. But it is also a time for us to get rid of some of the so-called phrases that have popped up from time to time. For instance, it is a time for us to get rid of the phrase that death is God's will. I'll never forget the anger of one family to whom I told that, because after a long and painful illness, their son had died. And for me to tell them that that illness and everything else was God's will was an incredibly awful thing and insensitive thing for me to say. I remember when we were talking or reading something about William Sloan Coffin. He used to be at Riverside Church. I don't know where he is now. I always envy fellows with three names in the ministry. It sounds so stentorian or something. William Sloan Coffin. His son was killed in an accident. And I guess Martin Marty's Context narrated this thing some years ago. And Coffin was in grieving. And he said one well-meaning, quiche-bearing neighbor walked in and said to him, well, it's obvious that it was God's will. Never was, he said to her. He said, I lit into her because she needed it. She needed to hear that, because for her to say that when my son's car went over that guardrail into the drink and he drowned, that that would make God the one who does that and puts murderers' hands around knives and causes people to kill themselves and causes all sorts of crazy and awful things to happen. We know that happens. We know that God allows it to happen. But he said, I maintained in the midst of my grief that when the waters closed over the roof of my son's car, that God's heart itself was the first to break. It is a way to know, again, of him who comes for to die. My hope, I guess, is that we, in our practice and care of persons, in the gift of pastoral ministry which is entrusted to us, can become in our proclamation what Carlisle Marney said, the guy from Interpreter's House, Presbyterian, I think, said some years ago, what an impact it will have on the church when Christians and pastors and people live and proclaim as if the resurrection is true. May that so be for us. Thanks for listening. I think we are, what, to discuss, to leave, to whatever, debate. Questions of anything or anyone? Okay.
What are some of the other phrases that kind of crop up that people use that are really annoying in these situations?
One of the classics is, I know how you feel. If people have a good relationship with you in the ministry and you tell them that, if they don't punch you, which would be the sign of a good relationship that they have with you, because you don't know how they feel, they will tell you, you know, you can't know how I feel. And so often that sort of phrase is said for all the right reasons. We're trying to identify, to have empathy for people, and that's one I'd stay away from too. Yeah. And what is as predictable as death is that you will probably say every one of the wrong phrases at least once in your ministry. It's a given, and the thing is not whether or not you're going to say them, but what you do with the aftermath of those kind of faux pas. Yeah?
I think what you said about not saying that was God's will. I once was in a funeral. It was a little boy that had died. He was only 7 months old, I think. And the pastor tried to not blame God for it and said, well, it was not God's fault. It was the evil forces that caused this to happen and so on. And for the parents, that was terrible to hear. And the father stepped forward after the son and said, it's a great comfort for us to know that it's Jesus that took our little boy to himself and not the devil. So there you have the opposite.
Yes.
And then I also have another question. You talked about saints who died, but sometimes the problem is that he who died is not a saint. The family, if they are Christians at least, or believe what the Bible says, know that according to the Bible, that person is not going to heaven.
That's correct.
What do you do about that?
I had made a hospital call in St. Louis some years ago on a relative of a family in the parish I served here. The question is, if you didn't all hear it, how do you deal with a family where the person who dies is not a Christian, but the family is? And I made a hospital call a while back, and I've forgotten which hospital, that's irrelevant, but I talked to the guy in bed. He was lying in bed and was very ill. And I'd been asked to go there. He had said it would be okay that I come. I always check that out too, especially if they're not a member in membership in a parish or even a member of a church. I talked to them and I said, well, you know, the family wanted me to come see you and maybe even offer you communion. I really didn't know him very well at all. And he said to me, well, that's okay, Pastor. I appreciate you coming to see me. If you want to commune me to make you feel better, that's fine. I suppose it's just as well to cover all the bases. And I did not commune him under those circumstances because it was clear to me that he didn't share the faith. And as we went on in the conversation, he said, besides, you know, when I die, they're just going to drop me in the ground, a hole in the ground like my old dog, my old faithful dog that died last year, and that's okay. He, in fact, died, and the family, to deal with them compassionately, because they know to tell them, first of all, that they cannot believe for someone else. The phrase in Paul where it talks about an unbelieving spouse or a believing spouse hanging in there with the faithless one so that by their witness they may be sanctified, that does not imply the family can believe for them. It does mean, at least as I understand that passage, by their witness that person may be won to the faith. If that does not occur, it takes a lot of compassion dealing with the family in terms of their own spiritual pilgrimage and to let them know that by their witness, they really have done all that is possible to do. Yeah. No. I would have, but I didn't. He was taken out of state. The reason I would have because it would have been a private service with the family only. This would not have been a church funeral, and the kind of access I had to the family would have made it appropriate, because there was no illusion about what this person had said or what his faith was. It would have been one of those, the phrase is, extraordinary instances of pastoral care. It is not a glossing over, oh well, he died, he was a nice guy, let's wheel him down the aisle and give him the full bore thing. That wasn't it at all. I could have, but under specific circumstances. I didn't, though. Yeah.
Under what circumstances do you not do a funeral when you're asked by your members, or sometimes people who probably on the phone say, yeah, this guy was Lutheran, I'm burying him.
Mm-hmm.
Under what circumstances do you not provide a Christian funeral?
Well, one of the first objective criteria is whether the person has been baptized. And I say that not in the magical sense at all. You know, baptism is sometimes thought by today's families to be kind of a spiritual measles shot. You know, you kind of do it along with the other stuff and get it over with, because that gets Grandma and Grandpa off your back too, you see. But you ask realistically, was the person baptized? Tell me about his history. And, you know, in Florida, there are so many snowbirds down there, a family will call because they're part-time residents. They may be active in a church up north. If I'm satisfied, not that activity in the church is the only criteria, but is there evidence that that person is a practicing or was a practicing Christian? That's one of the criteria that I use. If there's no evidence at all, I'm never available for that sort of thing. You know, even if it's Friday, which is my day off, I'm just not available. Other stuff? Yeah?
I just wanted to comment that I think it's so important that you're here sharing this topic with us, because this is where the rubber meets the road, sort of thing, in terms of our own appreciation of God's revelation, doctrine, comfort, Son. As you spoke, I was reminded of my own cousin's suicide. One of the elders of one of the congregations I served, who, after the late service, went home and blew his brains all over the bathroom with a shotgun. Reminded of a crib death where it was extremely difficult to get the casket closed, with the mother not allowing the funeral director to close it because she had wanted this open casket. And of other instances as well. But the whole idea of indeed this being no academic exercise that we're engaged here in this seminary, but in preparation for the ministry of the word to real people, and it's coming upon those in training here now real fast, and it is in effect an excellent exhortation to well use your time and opportunity here before the baptism with fire begins in earnest, and you're called upon to be God's instrument. Thank you for being here.
You know, one of the things that I, in the last three instances that I indicated, Lola and then the other three, the last three, common to all of those, I used with the family the question, you know, if anybody ever wants to ask the question, oh death, where is thy sting? You know, in Lola's case, you'd say that, hey, the emphasis would be, thanks be to God who gives us the victory. You say, oh death, where is thy sting, with the other three, and you gag right there, because the answer, the sting, is right here. In a suicide of a person who isolated herself, there were 35 people that I identified in the congregation who were telephone buddies of Carol. And all of them afterwards came to me saying, we feel so awful and so helpless. What else could we have done? And the answer is nothing. you know, O death, where is thy sting? J, you know, how do you figure that one out? The sting is all over the place there. And of course, Carissa, same deal. That's why I take great comfort in Paul's description of death, which is not God's will, but what does he call it? The last enemy. I like that better, because it's been destroyed. That's Jesus Christ. Yeah. Commenting on, you know, in a Christian funeral, using it as a chance for, oh yeah, yeah, I do that too. I don't use it as a time for evangelism, but I do talk very openly about why death has occurred. It is not just because someone's string has run out or it's the normal course of human events. Of course, you run into a suicide or an infant death or a tragic death, and you've got the circumstance is telling people that already. But even in the instance of Lola's death, to reflect really on even among the what we would, you know, say by any human level is a saint, even in that person's life, the rhythm of sin and forgiveness, of the reality of death means, yes, she is a sinner, but the promise of God of resurrection is there. And you expand that to hearers as well. People are very, very open to that sort of thing when funerals come. It's people will give you more compliments on a funeral sermon and wedding sermons usually because they're personal in the sense that they know the people involved. And secondly, funerals, of course, awake in us the awareness of our own mortality. You know, I was in tears at Old Trinity Sunday morning during the commemoration of the faithful departed. I didn't even know those people, but my own recollections were flipping, you know, of folks that I had seen, including some of these folks I talked about today. And to talk about them now in as we say, the nearer glory, that is a powerful and personal sort of moment, and you need to capitalize on that. Yeah, any other stuff? Thank you.